And welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. Very glad you are along for the ride this afternoon. Kevin Plank founded Under Armour in 1996. About 10 years later, he took the sports apparel company public, and today it employs nearly 350,000 people worldwide, and it's behind only Nike in the U.S. in the highly competitive sports apparel industry. Kevin Plank has big plans for Under Armour and for the city of Baltimore. Today, a conversation with the guy who runs Mr. Plank's private company, Plank Industries. Tom Geddes is the CEO of Plank Industries, whose portfolio includes, among other things, horse racing, rye whiskey, a hotel, a tech incubator, and Sagamore Development, the company behind the huge plan to create what many are calling a city within a city on the waterfront in South Baltimore. Port Covington will include a new corporate headquarters for Under Armour, coupled with housing, retail establishments, and recreation. The city of Baltimore has committed nearly $660 million in what's known as a TIF, or tax increment financing, which will provide infrastructure to support all of the new buildings and parks in Port Covington. The state and federal government will chip in as well. The total price tag for Port Covington is expected to be in the neighborhood of $5 billion. The company has also committed to hiring local residents for some of the construction jobs and permanent jobs, and they've agreed to about $100 million to fund things like job training, affordable housing, and profit sharing with the city. Many observers call the company's commitment to this community benefits agreement historic, with the potential to set the standard for such development projects nationwide. Tom Geddes, it's great to meet you. Thanks for coming in.
Tom, thanks so much for having me.
So you're 38 years old. You are a native of England, Surrey, a beautiful area of that country. You came to the U.S., I don't know, 20 years ago, something like that?
Yeah, it's about right. I came over for college and thought I was here for, you know, college and maybe a little longer, and ended up, I went back for a year, did grad school at Cambridge, and then came to a place called Baltimore where I was coming again for 2 years, and that was in 2002.
And that was for grad school?
That was for grad school.
At Hopkins?
At Hopkins, of course. And yeah. You know what Baltimore does to you. You come for 2 years, and 14 years later, here you are with kids and the best job in the world and loving the city and enjoying being here.
So. Well, I'm hip to that. I came 35 years ago and blinked, and that's 35 years later. How'd you meet Kevin Plank?
Believe it or not, we met on a playground, of all places. So both our girls were 2 years old at the time, and I think it was on, it might have been Halloween parade or something, and we were at school, preschool, and that's where we first met and got to know each other a little bit socially, and families got to know each other. But I didn't have a lot of time with him. He's a very busy guy, traveling the world, building, even at that time, a very fast-growing company. But I told him very early on, look, you know, we're going to be friends because I'm never going to bug you for a job. I don't know much about apparel, and having grown up in the UK, I don't even know that much about American sports, so I'll never be knocking on your door until maybe you get into cricket or something like that. So, but fast forward a few years, and he gave me a call one day and said, Tom, you know, my world outside of Under Armour is growing pretty quick, and I need to stay laser-focused on the company. And I'd like somebody with a diverse background, with some wealth management, with some nonprofit work, who could come in and put together a team and build something special outside of the company. So that was the opportunity I got about 4.5 years ago, and it's been nonstop ever since.
Yeah, pretty wild ride ever since, I would imagine.
For sure.
So what were you doing before? I heard at one point you were teaching school even. I mean, how did you go from school teacher to investment advisor?
You know, I've met folks around the country who do jobs like mine for the handful of people in the country like Kevin, and there's a lot of circuitous routes to get there because it's a pretty unique kind of role. I actually started out teaching. I was very sort of academic.
And this was
focused.
After grad school?
After
Hopkins?
Grad school, yep. And you know, while in grad school, I taught there at Hopkins and then taught after grad school. Mm-hmm. And something I always wanted to do for a couple of years. And
what were you teaching?
I was teaching history. Mm-hmm. So my background is in history. I was
to little kids or
to so in between college and grad school, I was out in Seattle and I had middle school kids at that time. But here in Baltimore, I was teaching high school. Mm-hmm. And taught AP European and World History. And there's actually a former student of mine now works at Plank Industries, which is kind of fun to see that, you know, someone who's now 26, 27 years old and growing fast in her professional career. Meandered through administration and schools and then into the nonprofit sector and then into wealth management. And right before I worked for Kevin, I was working in wealth management something I thought I'd do the rest of my life. I was at a great firm here in Baltimore and had a pretty good pace of life and enjoyed what I was doing and was helping families and institutions, nonprofit institutions in the city with their wealth management needs. And then I got that phone call one day and had lunch with Kevin the next day, and the world kind of turned upside down at that point. So
and he hired you not as a history teacher. He hired you as a wealth manager.
Yeah, no, I was probably 9 or 10 years out of teaching history, so I don't think I wouldn't have been a great hire for that role at the time.
What kind of guy is Kevin Plank? I mean, I've never met him. A lot of people don't know much about him other than he's very successful. He's hugely rich, and he lives in Baltimore.
Sure. No, he's... he's a born leader. He's a visionary. He's an entrepreneur, I think, first and foremost. I think that's what drives him every day is building things. And he's extraordinarily loyal. And I think, you know, not only to his team and the people around him, but also to his city. And I think that's what we have the ability every day to demonstrate is that loyalty that he has. He's high speed. There's no doubt about that. And you have to be on your game at all times and ready to keep up with him. And he delivers incredible performance and expects the same from others. But he's an incredible person to learn from and work with, and it's been the great honor of my life to come in and help him build a vision and to build a team of terrific people who are helping me to do that.
So why is there a Plank Industries? What does he get from this? He's got Under Armour. He owns this company, runs it. He's very involved day to day. So why does he start this thing called Plank Industries?
So it really started as a way to organize his own life outside of the company. That was sort of mission number one. But even on day one with putting together, making sure that he was firing on all cylinders as CEO of Under Armour, he already was having ideas and ambitions for I think he'd made the decision that the company was going to have its home in Baltimore. So he looked at kind of his profile and his position and saw an opportunity where he could do more than simply be the CEO and controlling stockholder of a public company in the city and could really take corporate citizenship to a different level and could put his own resources, his own, his own energy and his own team to work building things here in the city. So, we started really, he already owned Sagamore Farm. So, when I met him, he owned the farm. So that's why everything we have is called Sagamore. That was sort of the first business he owned outside of the company.
And that's an historic horse farm out in Baltimore County.
That's right. Beautiful 530-acre farm that was owned by the Vanderbilts and was sort of it was the crown jewel of Maryland horse racing for decades, and then had really sort of fallen into a little bit of disrepair when Kevin took it over, and he invested heavily in it and has made it a very special kind of asset within our state. So that was really all he was doing outside the company, and he had ideas and ambitions. And one of the things that came out of that was one of our first businesses, which is the Maryland Rye Whiskey. And you may ask, why whiskey? Well, there were a couple factors. One is there are these two streams that run through Sagamore Farm that meet at the little spring house, which you can see from Belmont Road as you drive by, that was built in 1909. And it has a natural spring bubbling up inside the spring house. It's a really cool feature of the farm. It's where farmers used to chill their milk in milk bottles because the water stays cool kind of year-round because it's coming up out of the limestone aquifer. So we tested the water more out of curiosity than anything else and found that it was going to be great water for making whiskey. It didn't have iron in it, which you don't want. You shouldn't be – if anybody likes whiskey, don't be putting your city tap water in your whiskey to mix it because you don't want iron in your water. But a little bit of calcium, and it was just very pure. It was great spring water. So
let me just interrupt. I mean, he's got great water, so he's making whiskey. So why is it – my question is, why is it that Plank Industries – is starting a whiskey company and not Under Armour? Why doesn't Under Armour invest in a whiskey company?
Well, I think, number one, I think the brands are a little bit disparate. You've got a health and fitness brand on the one hand that whiskey might not be the best fit. And, it wouldn't really
just
fit with
as
the
PR
of the company.
Thing?
Just with the business goals of the mission of the company. And the mission of Under Armour is to make all athletes better. And sure, there's a little bit of a contradiction.
Right, whiskey isn't going to help that. Yeah,
it's always in moderation. It's very good for the soul. So, but what it is, where there is a common theme, I think, with the farm and then into whiskey, is there's that Maryland tradition, this Maryland history. So, prior to Prohibition, rye whiskey was America's drink. And Maryland was the leader in horse racing at the time, and it was the leader in whiskey at the time. And, Prohibition really put a dent in Maryland's industry in a way it didn't in Kentucky and Tennessee. And then also, corn subsidies, I think, have been very good for bourbon, but not very good for rye. So,
but all these other investments, the hotel down on the Pier 5 down in – or the pier in Fells Point
yep.
These various other projects that have the tech thing, the tech startup that you have that's in Port Covington now – why is it that Under Armour isn't investing in that? Is that because the board of Under Armour says, look, we're sticking to sports apparel? I mean, there are plenty of industries that diversify,
sure.
And they have all sorts of different things. General Electric, does everything from you know, financing car loans to building jet engines. I mean, is there anything inherently wrong with Under Armour investing that?
Well, you know, Under Armour is it's 20 years old, it's still a relatively young and very fast-growing company, and I think the company has a singular focus, which is making athletes better. And it's not a GE type conglomerate. It is a company focused in one sector. And so I think your question, though, Tom, is what does it all add up to? You know, where does plank industries come from? These seemingly disparate interests, like hotels, whiskey, the water taxi now, City Garage, which you referenced, which is the manufacturing and entrepreneurship innovation center in Port Covington. And then horse racing, what does it all add up to? It really adds up to, you know, when Kevin Plank thinks about how am I going to invest a dollar outside of Under Armour? And he really asks himself two questions. One is, will it help Under Armour? Because that's, you know, sort of the mothership. And number two, will it help Baltimore? So one thing you'll see is, we have a hotel, we have a whiskey business, we have a manufacturing innovation center, we have a water taxi service, we have a horse farm, we have a philanthropic foundation. What do they all have in common? The one thing they all have in common is Baltimore. So a company, a big, you know, global public company wouldn't necessarily have that singular focus on one city or region. And that's something that Kevin's been able to do and that's been a real passion for him.
Is one of his aspirations to be a leader in this city? I mean, does he see himself as doing that? And does he see that as good for Under Armour or that as good for him personally? And is Baltimore the only city in which he wants to be thought of as a civic leader? Because obviously you have presences in 26 other states, as far as I can tell.
Well, first thing I would say is I think he's already quite clearly a civic leader in Baltimore. I think, you know, from his participation in the investments he's making in the city, the commitments he's made publicly to the city, he's demonstrated that he's willing to spend time, energy, and resources on being an advocate for Baltimore. But I think his ambition is to build great things and to build great things in our city and, you know, to use the engine that is Under Armour and the opportunity that he has with his personal resources to sort of leverage the fact that that company is here to make our city better and stronger and more inclusive. And that's been a focus for him. So, you know, if your question is he thinking of doing something other than being, you know, running Under Armour, I think he's singularly focused on that right now. That's the perspective.
My question is actually is it is important to him to be a person who's going to move the dial in the city of Baltimore.
I think he thinks
of Baltimore as a project, sort of.
I
don't mean that in a you know, deleterious way.
I think I would say he sees it as his responsibility and his opportunity. So he often says that no city needs any particular company. And we'll talk more about Port Covington, but you'll notice he never ran a process to go see if he could take the company somewhere else. But he doesn't think that necessarily, you know, any particular company is the solution for a city. The solutions for cities are complex, multi-layered, involve public sector, private sector, nonprofit sector, involve sort of generational approaches to how you can actually make cities better. There's no magic bullet. But at the same time, a company with the right commitment and with the right leader can help a city. And when you have somebody who's willing to take significant personal resources that, frankly, they could use for anything they chose to do, and to say, I'm going to deploy those in Baltimore because I believe I can make it better, then I think it's really that he sees, you know, that it's his responsibility to do so.
He grew up in Kensington. Mm-hmm. He didn't grow up here. I mean, mm-hmm. I'm just wondering. I mean, I think a lot of people are very grateful that he's got this kind of corporate, civic, philanthropic commitment to the city. But where'd it come from?
You know, Baltimore was a great home for Under Armour when the company was still very young. When he moved the company from, you know, the company started in his grandmother's basement in Washington, D.C., with him and one other guy, Kip Fulks, and a few other friends around him helping to pack up T-shirts and ship them out. And for the first 5 years, they only made one T-shirt. And they moved up to Baltimore, I think, in 1998. And the city really became a home for the company. And so while it was born in D.C. and while he was born, you know, essentially in D.C., all of the growth has happened here in Baltimore City. So he's had a long time to, you know, as a resident here and as a leader here to absorb. You know, I think he's culturally a very good fit with Baltimore. He's a very down-to-earth person. He's very, you know, he likes, I think, the sort of underdog status that our city has a little bit. It appeals to him. And it's just been a great place for him to grow his company. So he really has sort of adopted it as his hometown and frankly is more of a cheerleader for it than many people are for their own hometowns where they were born and raised.
So you're an investment advisor, mm-hmm. right? If Mr. Plank didn't have this sort of obsession and deep apparent love for the city of Baltimore and you were just starting from scratch, here's a guy with a bazillion bucks, and he says, okay, Tom, I need to invest this. Would you recommend this strategy of starting a bunch of companies in Baltimore?
That's a great question. I think You know, folks with my background and temperament are more likely to come in and say, you know, of course, Kevin, we need to talk about diversification. And I think in my first couple of weeks, I probably had those conversations with him and might as well have jumped in front of a freight train, because he had a very singular vision for, you know, of course, you know, you're going to be prudent and sensible with your resources. But when it comes to making big bets, and when it comes to doing interesting and exciting investments that you could do anywhere around the country, around the world, he said, no, we're going to do it here because it's going to add up to something more than the sum of its parts. So whether it is, you know, connecting the harbor with the water taxi, whether it is building and growing small companies here and investing in them, whether it is sort of resurrecting traditions and industries like rye whiskey or like horse racing, it all ties together to something bigger than the sum of its parts because it's all here.
Tom Geddes is the CEO of Plank Industries. We'll have more with Tom Geddes, and you can join our conversation 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wipr.org. Want to send us a tweet? Our handle is @MiddayTomHall. We're going to talk about Port Covington when we come back. Looking forward to your calls, questions, and comments. Stick around. Welcome back, everybody. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on the program, Dr. Lena Nguyen stops by for our monthly midday health watch. Dr. Nguyen is Baltimore's health commissioner. We'll talk about a new initiative to improve outcomes for young kids. And we'll look at the encouraging news that the infant mortality rate in 2015 in Baltimore was the lowest ever. That's midday health watch coming up tomorrow at noon. If you've just joined us today, my guest is Tom Geddes, the CEO of Plank Industries, which is the private business organization of Kevin Plank, the founder, chairman, and CEO of Under Armour. Under Armour is one of, if not the most visible and successful companies here in Baltimore. Plank Industries is the parent company of Sagamore Development, which is behind the massive project at Port Covington. You are welcome to join our conversation. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall, our email address, midday@wipr.org, and our phone number, 410-662-8780. Tom Geddes, what does ultimately Under Armour get out of this investment in Port Covington? And how, I know you work for Plank Industries, mm-hmm. you don't work for Under Armour, but as your understanding of the corporate culture of Under Armour, how does this resonate, this project and this plan resonate with that corporate culture?
So I think the key for Under Armour, the single biggest piece they get out of this, is that they get to build the campus in one centralized location, you know, the headquarters function. Obviously, Under Armour has 20-plus offices around the country and around the world, and there are companies in various industries that are growing in a decentralized way and are sort of shying away from the centralized corporate headquarters. I think, as you said, I am to some extent an outsider, although I sit very close to it. Culture is really important at Under Armour, as I think it is at most successful companies. It's, you know, the collisions that happen in hallways, the collaboration, the absorption of the brand, whether you've been at the company for a week or for 10 years is critical. And I think their ability to have everybody in one place is important for keeping that corporate culture intact and making sure that as the company grows, as it has very quickly, that all stays intact. So that's one piece. I think, you know, the flip side of it is what Baltimore gets is Baltimore gets to keep a lot of that growth here, because I think throughout this process we knew that Under Armour headquarters would probably stay in Baltimore, but the question was how big would it be and how much of that growth might happen here or might happen in New York or San Francisco or San Antonio or Amsterdam or wherever it might be. So,
then is it incumbent upon you? Excuse me for interrupting, sure. But is it incumbent upon you then to make Baltimore writ large, not just Port Covington, mm-hmm. not just this little place where the company headquarters is going to be, but Baltimore writ large, a place where a new person thinking about working for Under Armour would want to come? I mean, is the attractiveness of the city overall part of your goal here?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's you know, a sort of a self-serving element to it, in that if it's a more attractive place to live and work, you know, the company can attract better talent and we can attract better talent too. But there's also an altruistic component to that as well, which says if we are going to witness and to some extent control this kind of growth, why don't we make it have a real impact in one place rather than spreading it in a disparate way around the country or other places, and especially in a city that is in need of investment and is in need of jobs. and is in need also of great stories that are very positive for the city. So I think it's a win-win, which is why it's made sense and is why we've been able to move the ball forward.
So what do you think about the potential danger for creating this little Shangri-La down there in Port Covington, this beautiful, hip, new, great place? I bet it'll have great restaurants and great apartments and great parks and great stuff. What's the danger of that being this little segregated island and the rest of the city is still another, you know, very problematic place?
Well, what it boils down to, I think, is two things. One is connectivity and the other is opportunity. So something we see in Baltimore today, you know, prior to even anything being built in Port Covington, is that it's very challenging to the city has challenges with transportation and connection. And it's, the reason why we have pockets around the city. There are historic reasons for that, but there are also current realities around transportation, the ability to get from a home in one neighborhood to a job in another neighborhood. So critical to our plan from day one has been, how do we make sure that Port Covington is not isolated? And I've always taken issue with the idea of a city within a city. To me, it's a neighborhood. It's a piece. It's a wonderful piece of a city that was disconnected by historical factors, first a railroad, then a highway. That meant that, you know, part of Baltimore that should be engaged with the rest of the city was really underutilized and disconnected. And I think this is not a project of building some isolated city within a city. It's really a project of reconnecting Baltimore to its waterfront and, frankly, reconnecting most of Baltimore to the South Baltimore Six neighborhoods, which is a really key part of the engagement and the plan that we've had. There are neighborhoods that people, frankly, don't even know are part of Baltimore City, from, you know, Brooklyn, Cherry Hill, Westport, Mount Wyandotte, Lakeland, and Curtis Bay. You know, we want to make sure that Port Covington can rather than the opposite of being an island, is really more of a bridge from Baltimore to the rest of those neighborhoods. So, to your question about the sort of amenities that will be in Port Covington, the opportunities, we have to make sure those opportunities are shared. And that's a lot of what we went through with this, the process we've just completed around the conversations around the TIF and the Associated Community Benefits Agreement is how do we make sure that people can access the employment opportunities, both in construction, which will be really significant. If it's done right, it'll be tens of thousands of new construction jobs in Baltimore City. And then in the permanent jobs and opportunities, whether it's this reason why City Garage, which is about keeping companies in Baltimore, small growing companies, young entrepreneurs, people who are putting people to work, that was the first thing we did. The first thing we did in Port Covington was not a hotel. It was not a restaurant. It was not anything else that could, frankly, be cash flowing and making money. It was a money loser that is designed to tell the story of opportunity in Baltimore and create realities of opportunity for people who want to grow businesses here.
On 88.1, it's midday. My guest today is Tom Geddes. I'm Tom Hall. Our telephone number, 410-662-8780. 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wypr.org. And our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Janet, in Southwest Baltimore, you're on Midday with Tom Geddes. Thanks for your call.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. Tom just talked about that. And I was happy to hear about his altruistic approach to developing business, because I am concerned about this becoming this little segregated, gentrified area that totally ignores the rest of Baltimore. So if you can tell me again, or just speak to how, you know, some of your specific plans, or at least you have the intentions of spreading it throughout Baltimore. I live in Southwest Baltimore, and we have nothing up here, really, nothing. So I'll hang up, and I'll take your answer off the phone.
Great. Well, thank you, Janet, for the call. I understand that one of the first moves you're going to make in terms of the development is to start building some of this affordable housing that's part of the community benefits agreement. Is that going to be in Port Covington, or is it going to be offsite?
So it's going to be a mix, and that was something we learned in the course of our very extensive conversations in the community. Was, you know, there was pressure from housing advocates, you know, rightly, to say we want to make sure this is an accessible site for people who can't necessarily afford expensive apartments or accommodations to live. But as we had conversations with community groups, with residents around the city, a lot of what we heard was, we want to see more affordable housing in Baltimore, but don't build it all in Port Covington, because, you know, I live here. My mother lives there. My job is here. My church is there. And I don't want to move to something new in Port Covington, but I'd like to see something done about the housing that we have in our own neighborhood. So as we sort of navigated our way through these conversations, a commitment we made was that some of the affordable housing we would do would be on site and some would be in other places around the city. Hopefully leveraging off of projects that other people are already carrying out to make sure that we can really add to the momentum that's happening in that area.
There is a fear on the part of some of the affordable housing advocates who were with you at the table negotiating this community benefits agreement that the reason you don't want the affordable housing in Port Covington is that it denigrates or lowers the property values of the other housing for all these wonderful new hip employees that are going to come to work at Under Armour.
No, not at all. I think the challenge with, and disclosure is I'm not an expert in affordable housing, and I'm not an expert, frankly, in real estate development. We have a team that focuses on that. But what I know is that it's about the financeability. Affordable housing has to be subsidized by somebody for it to work economically. So the process we went through with really terrific partners and, Bill, as you know, Baltimoreans United and Leadership Development was sort of the group that ultimately helped us navigate through this and get to a point where we could commit to 20% of housing being affordable. It really helped us navigate, how do you actually finance this? How do you pay for this? Because it's not about, we like the most inclusive development possible. We like the most inclusive housing possible, but you have to make sure economically it works because we have to go and raise a lot of private money to build this. The other thing I would really highlight is, Port Covington, again, is not an island. It is a peninsula. It's not an island. You only have to zoom out one click. And if you go stand in front of City Garage, you're not looking at Federal Hill. You're not looking at Canton. You're looking at Cherry Hill. You're looking at a neighborhood in Baltimore with a median income of just over $19,000, with very high unemployment, with significant community needs, with great community leadership with whom we've engaged closely and gotten very close. And I think that done right, which it's absolutely our intention to do this right, it will be something that will lift all ships and will be highly beneficial and will not be about gentrification at all. Going back even to the inception of this, one of the reasons Port Covington was attractive to Kevin Plank personally was that there is not really a population there. The nighttime population of Port Covington is about 20, and 17 of those are cats. This is not a place where you're worrying about displacing people from their homes, and that was really critical to if we were going to do something on this scale. Making sure that we weren't putting people out of their homes was really important to us.
Tom Geddes is the CEO of Plank Industries. Samuel, you're calling from Littleton, Pennsylvania. Welcome to the show with Tom Geddes.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Hey, I think it's terrific what Kevin Plank is doing for Baltimore City, putting his corporate office and everything at Port Covington. But the other day I was in Dick's Sporting Goods, and I saw all the apparel, Under Armour shirts and everything, and caps. And every label I looked at said made in China. So I was just wondering, why can't this stuff be made in America?
Tom Geddes, do you know much about that?
Well, as you highlighted, Tom, I don't work for Under Armour. It's not what I do. And I sort of joked earlier about telling Kevin I'd never work for him because apparel's not my specialty. So
The day after the election, in a publication called Footwear News, of all things, mm-hmm. Mr. Plank said, look, we have 350,000 people working for us at any given time around the world, and we can't guarantee that 175,000 of those jobs are going to come to the United States. I guess the economics just don't work. But when there – and you have a job training dimension to this community benefits agreement, can you train people and can you make it economically feasible? In other words, your job training is going to be for what? What are you going to train them to do?
Well, you've highlighted it really well, Tom. If we're going to repatriate jobs, especially in these sectors that have largely gone overseas in manufacturing in particular, it's going to have to be through innovation because we are a global society. We're a global economy. For a company like Under Armour, speaking as an outsider from the company, if they were simply to say we're going to make everything in the United States, they could probably do that, and they could probably be a very, very small apparel company. They certainly wouldn't be employing 2,500 people in Baltimore City, another couple thousand at Curtis Bay, and growing every year, and competing with global giants because it's not possible to do under the way economics work. Even if they wanted to go and find manufacturing in the United States, it doesn't exist. It's not there. It's shrunk dramatically over the last 20 or 30 years. So I think I mentioned that City Garage was our first project in Port Covington, and the goal of City Garage, I think of it as the lab for how do you do made in America in the 21st century. So in City Garage, there are three components. The Foundry, which is a makerspace where if you have an idea and you want to come and almost for the cost of a gym membership, you use incredibly expensive equipment to figure out how do you make your product and see if it's viable. Then we have Main Street, which is where we have businesses, small companies that we've invested in, all of which make a tangible product. So it's not a tech incubator. This is not really a place where apps are getting created. This is a place where people are making skateboards. That's where our whiskey is being bottled right now. It's a very hands-on place. There is a robotics company there.
So your hope then would be that these folks can figure out a different way of making shoes, a different way of making hats, a different way of making T-shirts.
Right. So the third component is actually Under Armour has part of the space for their project called the Lighthouse, which is designed designed to figure out exactly how do you do process innovation in the apparel industry. So a shoe is made the same way today that it was 80 or 100 years ago, and hundreds of hands have to touch it, and it's pieced together. And, you know, there's other industries, and if you just look at cell phones, for example, the technology in the phone that's in my back pocket, Kevin always alludes to this, 30 or 40 years ago, you'd have to had a Greyhound bus to have that much computing power, and it wouldn't have taken phones or taken pictures or played songs. So the innovation that's happened in other industries, I think Under Armour is trying very hard to bring to manufacturing in its own space, but it's going to take innovation and it's going to take time.
Of the permanent jobs that you're expecting, hoping to have in Port Covington once this project is done, and we should remind folks that this project is a decades-long affair, as many as 40 years. What kinds of permanent jobs? Your target number is about 26,500 jobs. What are those folks going to be doing? And my second question is, can you hire those folks from Cherry Hill
right.
that you're looking at, you know, when you stand on the water?
Well, one of the first things we're engaged with right now is a workforce development program that we intend both to address needs in construction and meeting the local hiring goals and mandates that we've set around construction, but also that we want it to be training for a whole diverse set of jobs that, that are out there. So, you know, we don't know. I can't predict what the jobs will be. I could predict in general based on the mix of office and retail that we expect to have on the site. But we hope, you know, the hope is that partnering with public agencies, with the city and the state and others, we can really attract other companies to come and make Baltimore their home because of the amount of land and opportunity that we have in Port Covington, and that we can help to train up a Baltimore City workforce that's able to take not just the construction jobs, not just the retail jobs, as important as those are, and great careers can be made in both, but that they're also trained up for other kinds of jobs. We need to have, and we can't do all of this. You know, there are great partners out there. There are great folks out there working on this, but we need to have kids learning how to code in Baltimore City public schools. We need to have kids ready for all kinds of 21st century jobs. And that's something that we're going to be a close partner with all of those agencies and providers over the years to come.
Donald Trump talked in the campaign about bringing manufacturing jobs back to the United States. Did Mr. Plank support Mr. Trump for president? Did he contribute to that campaign? Did he contribute to the campaign of Mrs. Clinton? Obviously, people with that kind of money get asked. You're the guy that signed some of those checks. I mean, what did he do?
I did not sign any checks for Mr. Trump, and I, you know, I don't think it'd be productive to spend a lot of time on the presidential election. It's not really. We hope it's not going to be particularly relevant for the project. I know he has come out and said that he has a focus on infrastructure, and we hope that will be positive for Baltimore and for Maryland. We haven't heard much else yet on a policy perspective, but you know, I think it's good news that that's the first thing that we've heard. The promises made around manufacturing jobs, I think, you know, I would say as a matter of personal opinion, since we're engaged in this work, those are easy to make and difficult to deliver, and I hope they are delivered. I think we will be on the leading edge of that locally in Baltimore in terms of what we're doing at City Garage. But I think what it boils down to is America's greatest, one of America's greatest attributes and one of America's greatest exports, which is entrepreneurship. And if you can help to sort of really celebrate entrepreneurship, really make it possible and make it more equitable and create opportunities for kids in the city of Baltimore to be exposed to it, to have access to it. You know, talent is everywhere. Opportunity is not. So if we can find a way within our city and within our region to make sure that that opportunity is spread to where that talent is, we're already seeing it. We're already seeing it in City Garage. We have guys who came out of Baltimore City who are making a product, selling a product and hiring people. And I think that's what we want to focus on rather than worrying about things that we can't control.
Tom Geddes is my guest today. He's the CEO of Plank Industries, the private business arm of Kevin Plank, who's the founder, chairman, and CEO of Under Armour. We got a bunch of folks waiting on the line. Please be patient. Hang with us while we take a quick break. If you'd like to join us as well, the phone number 410-662-8780, our email address midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle @MiddayTomHall. We'll be back in a flash. Hang out. Welcome back to Midday. If you're just joining us, my guest this hour is the CEO of Plank Industries, Tom Geddes. We're talking about Kevin Plank, the founder of Under Armour, and his plans for Port Covington and for Baltimore. In late September, the city of Baltimore approved about $660 million in tax increment financing to support the new Under Armour headquarters, retail stores, and housing in Port Covington. Tom Geddes was part of the negotiating team that agreed on a package worth more than $100 million to support things like job training, affordable housing, and profit sharing with the city, along with other support for neighborhoods surrounding Port Covington. We welcome your questions and comments for Tom Geddes, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org, our Twitter handle @MiddayTomHall. The phone lines are full. Before we go to those phones, and I promise we will get there quick, I want to, Tom, just do a couple of quick things. When are the bonds going to be issued? What's the time frame of this? I know that you're also at Sagamore Development, and you're the boss of that boss. Mark Weller's the guy who runs Sagamore Development. You're his he's your direct report, however that works. You're attempting to get approval of about $350 million in state funding and another $225 million from the feds. Is that money is the TIF contingent on that money? What's how does the Rubik's Cube get put together here?
Well, the first thing is you were right when you said this is Mark Weller's world. This is what he spends his time on with his team, and he has a terrific team of folks who have expertise in public financing as well as in development. So it's his responsibility in his area, and he's really Kevin's partner on this project. But I think the first issuance of bonds we expect sometime next year. It's dependent on a number of other factors. Most importantly, we have to go and raise a lot of private money. As much focus as there's been on public infrastructure, the lion's share of this project will be funded with private money. And some from Kevin, who's already obviously put in all of the money that's in the project to date, but a lot from other investors outside as well. And one of the most exciting things about this project is the ability to bring that kind of outside private investment to Baltimore City. So we have to line up, there's a lot of execution that has to happen before the first set of TIF bonds will be authorized, because the project has to demonstrate viability. It has to be ready to go. There's some initial infrastructure work that can get underway. But for the larger amount of this funding to be authorized and to be issued, there has to be, real progress on the project from a private investment perspective. So that's the real focus.
A few months ago, $76 million federal grant, which was going to help change the interchange around 95, was turned down. You didn't get that money. I mean, are any of these steps along the way deal breakers? I mean, are any of these things that can squash this whole business?
No, the federal grant process is nationally competitive, as you know. So there was no expectation going in. And at the time, the TIF had not been authorized and it was not signed off on. So that was a significant limiting factor to bringing that federal money to Baltimore.
So the TIF is going to put you in a better spot to get it the next time.
Absolutely, yeah. It's critically important. You know, the federal government wants to know that there is state and local buy-in to the project and that those resources are there. The state has been terrific to work with as well, and we feel confident that they will do what they need to do to make this happen and to invest in Baltimore. So, no, I think we feel confident as we navigate through this process that we'll be able to get the resources we need to connect the project into West Baltimore, to connect the project onto I-95, to put the light rail in, and everything we need to, as I spoke of earlier, make sure that this project is connected into the rest of the city.
Okay, Tom Geddes is the CEO of Plank Industries. Let me try to grab a few phone calls. Greg from Butcher's Hill, welcome to Midday with Tom Geddes.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Tom. Listen, I was a little disturbed the other day to read that one of the first planned buildings in the project is this ginormous parking garage, which is not really the way I want to see the city developed. I know you're after highway improvements and a light rail line, and good luck getting the money for that. But I'm wondering what you are doing to make the project as bikeable and walkable so future employees or customers can walk over from Westport or Cherry Hill, or so I could bike from my house in Butcher's Hill.
Sure. No, thank you for the question. It's Port Covington is actually the plan that we have for transportation in Port Covington is probably the most aggressive multimodal transportation plan that has ever been laid out in the city. The goal is a 50-50 split of access to the site by car and by other means. And by other means, we mean all of them. We're looking at where a bike path is going to be one of the first things put in. Pedestrian access is critical. It's extremely hard to achieve right now. We've worked with the state on bus access to make sure that the new bus system and the existing bus system connect into the city, into the site. Light rail is going to be an important focus of this. So I think the story that you read, I think, may have skewed your view of the project and its plans. I think it was related to the Under Armour campus, and they obviously have a need for a significant amount of parking on the expectation they're going to have 3+ million square feet of campus there ultimately. But we are talking to everybody who provides every kind of alternative transportation, and we want to make sure it's walkable and bikeable and accessible by public transportation. And I think we've probably got the most aggressive plan that you'll ever see in the city.
I want to keep going to the phones. Monroe from Baltimore, you're on Midday with Tom Geddes. Thanks for your call.
Yeah, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Some of my comments were from your prior caller, but I think it would be neater since Baltimore Transit is expecting to be nothing but a diesel fuel system. I think it would be back, bring back memories, if you could get an old-fashioned trolley line to take care of passengers, if not, maybe having the light rail come in and connect, because that way that would bring people from Anne Arundel County, or that would bring people from Baltimore County, northern Baltimore.
Okay, well, Monroe, thank you for your call. Appreciate it. Tom Geddes, is the trolley line part of the plan at the moment?
I think Monroe is reading Kevin Plank's mind, because it was one of, you know, to the extent he's had design input or ideas on this, one of the things he talked about was we actually went and looked at the museum that sits on, you know, underneath of the highway on that spur of Falls Road to look at the history of trolley cars in Baltimore. It's something we'd love to have as a component of the site, you know, as part of the visitor experience. It may not be one of the more practical transportation solutions, but light rail absolutely is. And I think a light rail spur coming out of Westport that first and most importantly connects into the city and makes it possible for residents to access jobs and opportunities that are in the site is really important to us. And secondly, it could connect into the airport and could be a really good way for Port Covington to have accessibility to BWI, which in turn will make it more attractive for companies to relocate here and come to Baltimore. So that's all part of the plan.
Pennymore, you're calling from Locust Point. Welcome to Midday. Thanks for your call.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to say I really enjoy your shows.
Well, thanks.
Keep up the good work.
Appreciate it.
I just wanted to say I went over to the Foundry, the place where, you know, there's this incubator.
City Garage down there in Port Covington.
City Garage, yes. And it's a giant big box building like Walmart that you can knock down when you're done and then build all your condos. But there was hardly anybody working there. There was some Caucasian young males that had a skateboard company. There was only like seven of them, all including the workers. I mean, there's nobody down there. It was like a ghost town. So why don't you explain more to people how they can benefit from that place? And also, I'll take my call off the air, but I just wanted to say, you know, we do need assisted living and nursing homes here on the west side for people, like people in Cherry Hill. Thank you very much.
All right, thanks, Pennymore. So I guess the City Garage is still in its, you know, early stages.
Yeah, it sounds like she came on a quiet day, but it is in its early stages. But for history, City Garage was actually the City Garage. It was where fire trucks, ambulances were fixed. It is a big box because that's what the city needed to be able to drive buses in and out of. And it was sitting, crumbling, and doing absolutely nothing. And it certainly could have. And in fact, in an early iteration of the plan, it could have been probably more productively and certainly more profitably could have been scraped away and replaced with something else. But the decision we made was that we wanted to put a flag in the ground in Port Covington that was about entrepreneurship, that was about manufacturing, it was about process innovation. And it sounds like the caller walked down the Main Street section where, as you know, in the early stages of companies leasing up and moving in, the skateboard company, which was about to leave not just the state but also the country, we were able to invest in and attract back and keep here in Baltimore. But there are now, if you go and visit today, you'll see a lot more action. We have a couple African-American guys from the city who have a really exciting company making these extraordinarily stylish bags and other products, leather goods. We have a robotics company. We have the University of Maryland has a presence in there. We have our whiskey team building. The Foundry, which is the makerspace, can often be a little empty during the day because most people come. It's a place where people come after work because that's where they have time to test out their ideas. But the Foundry is going to be a home for it's going to be really step one in our workforce development program. So we are right now working on bringing people who need workforce development and training through the Foundry to learn key skills, whether it's working with various kinds of tools, whether it's welding, whether it's manufacturing. And what the caller would not have seen was the Under Armour component, because that is obviously owned by Under Armour and it's private. It's not open for public visits. But that is a hive of activity around process innovation for that company and for how they're going to work on making local for local, not just in the United States, but around the world and really changing the paradigm of manufacturing.
All right, got a couple of questions about Westport. We've got an anonymous listener emailing us talking about the 45 acres of land in Westport that Mr. Plank bought from Patrick Turner. And Greg, you're on the line from Westport. I guess your question concerns the same thing. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely. We are on, you know, proverbial pins and needles there because there hasn't been an announcement yet on exactly he actually wants to do there. So I was wondering if you have any details at all now, Tom.
So West,
thanks for the call, Greg.
Thank you. The acquisition of Westport made sense because, number one, it was really dying for a buyer at the time. There was an attempt made to build a big mixed-use project there that didn't work, in part because of market timing. So it made sense strategically with putting together all of Port Covington to acquire that and to have that as an opportunity to connect into the project. To date, and as you can see in all the publicly available plans, there is not yet a plan for Westport as part of that development. I think it's too early for us to know. Just frankly, to have planned, zoned, entitled, achieved the TIF, and everything that's been done on a project just the size of Port Covington, which is one of the largest urban redevelopments in the country, with the opportunity to create more jobs than almost any other redevelopment, is a feat unto itself. And our real estate team at Sagamore Development has moved mountains to achieve what they've done. So it's really more a function of, that's been a huge lift already, and I think Westport will come next. I think it's too early to say that we know what will be there. I think we know that we will want to see significant investment there. And then Westport, the community, is part of the SB6, South Baltimore 6 group, that we are engaging with on a community benefits perspective. So we have a very vested interest in seeing success for Westport.
Is the community benefits agreement a paradigm for how development should be done moving forward, not only here in Baltimore, but in the city but around the country? And what about the potential criticism that people say this is going to scare developers off? It costs you guys $100 million to get this TIF. There are folks who don't have this kind of passion and love for Baltimore who may say, forget it, I'm going to Indianapolis or Phoenix or something. I mean, what's your take on that?
My take is that, number one, it's about scale. This is a massive project. It requires massive infrastructure, which is why the TIF is over 20, 30 years, so sizable. It's sizable in both time and in dollars. Number two, there is a sort of uniqueness in that Kevin Plank is willing and able to do more than any quote-unquote developer would ever do. And while I think there were some paradigm shifts in how you engage with the community, I don't see them as about dollars and cents. I see the shift as about the extent to which people doing large-scale developments are going to engage with the communities and stakeholders that have the most to gain or lose, and to make sure that it is inclusive. I think that's what I'm proud of, is the ground that we broke in how we engage with the community. So,
is it going to scare other people off?
I think the opposite. I think Port Covington, the ground that we are laying at Port Covington, I think will attract a tremendous amount of investment and opportunity in the city. I think that the folks we dealt with on a community discussion basis are very reasonable. They understand market realities. I think when people come who don't have the kind of profile of someone like Kevin Plank, they'll understand that. I think they'll size and scale appropriately to the size of projects that come. And my hope is that there are terrific businessmen and investors in the city, and we hope more coming every day, and we hope more who are homegrown every day. And I think hopefully this is a turning point where we see more and more investment in Baltimore, not less.
5 seconds. Denise is on the line. We can't talk to Denise, but her question is, what school is Port Covington going to be zoned for? Do you know?
It's too early, I think, to know as residential gets developed. So I think we'll
get back to you on that. All right. Tom Geddes is the CEO of Plank Industries, the private investment arm of Kevin Plank, which includes Sagamore Development, the company behind the massive project in South Baltimore known as Port Covington. We will, of course, continue to follow the development of Port Covington as it comes to fruition over the next months and years. We've got a link to more information on our website, wypr.org/midday. Tom Geddes, great to meet you. Thanks so much.
Tom, thanks for having me. Renewed my membership this morning, and everyone else should do the same.
Well, God bless. That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow on the broadcast, Dr. Lena Nguyen joins me for the monthly Midday Health Watch. She'll take your calls and comments, and we'll talk about some of the initiatives of the Baltimore City Health Department that are being implemented to improve the health and well-being of Charm City citizens. I hope you can join me and Dr. Nguyen tomorrow on Midday. Thanks to Joe Squared for providing lunch today. Joe Squared serves coal-fired pizzas, risotto, and local craft beers. Locations and hours on the web at joesquared.com. By the way, tonight at 5 o'clock at the University of Maryland School of Social Work, I'll be moderating a panel to discuss the impact of the election of Donald Trump on social justice issues. EJ Dion, DeRay McKesson, and Kimberly Moffitt will join me, and you are welcome to join us as well. We've got a link to information about that event on our website, wypr.org/midday. Thanks so much for listening. Thanks to everybody who called and emailed and tweeted today. We look forward to being with you again tomorrow. Until then, on behalf of the entire Midday team, I'm Tom Hall. Have a great day.